Kia ora, welcome to Asian and Aotearoa. I'm Jenna, and in this episode, I catch up with Erica Lee. Erica is a Korean-born, New Zealand-raised writer and sociologist by training. She's a theory and philosophy nerd, and we had a lot of fun in this ep talking about relationships and just generally what's going on in her world right now. Enjoy. I must have been around this time last year. I was hanging out with Stephen 6x4. I don't know if whether I'd had funding yet. I asked him, oh, do you know anyone who'd be good? And he was like, you need to read this paper by Erica. Do you refer to yourself as Erica or your Korean name?
Erica. My Korean name is Heiji, but I've decidedly chosen to go by Erica. And I've spent so long trying to like shape the rationale around it. And the main reason actually is that even in Korean, the only people who would call me by my Korean name are my friends who are the same age or my like parents or grandparents. Because in Korean, you would, I don't know, call me auntie, uncle, sister, or like, you know, like there's like different reference words.
Yes.
And so your name is actually something that's reserved for people who are really intimate to you. And also your name is always like attached to something like Heiji Onni, which is like Erica Onni, Erica sister, right?
Yeah.
But then if you just use it on its own, that it just feels... I don't know. It makes me feel really naked when people call me by my Korean name. And like really vulnerable. I don't know. Maybe my aversion, maybe it's some, I don't know. Maybe there's something to it, some psychic thing to it. But I prefer Erica. And also most people butcher the pronunciation.
I'm sure. And I'll be one of them. So that is how you came up on my radar.
Right.
Through Stephen, the legend, whom I love.
Beautiful soul.
So gorgeous. Anyway, welcome, Erica.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Born in Korea.
Yes.
How old were you when you moved here?
11.
Sociologist by training.
Mm-hmm.
Theory/philosophy nerd.
Mm-hmm.
Lover of performance arts and theatre. Trying to build a career teaching theory for people to engage critically in society.
Mm-hmm.
And you also teach. Anything else?
No.
That sums it up.
Yeah, I am a person who does these things and likes those things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You filled out the onboarding form really well. I appreciate that you...
Oh, really?
Because sometimes people like David don't put anything, or they put in like a couple words, but you kind of thought about each theme, I can see, you know?
Yeah.
And I like that.
When I was looking back at it, I thought, oh, maybe it's too brief.
Really? No, it was actually one of the most thorough.
Oh, really?
I mean, it was really good. So we're just going to fucking roll with it. And then if you have a question for me, let's just have a chat.
All right, cool.
I'm operating on not much sleep. So we're just kind of...
Likewise. So this will be really unhinged and I'm really uncensored.
This is what's going to happen. As I was driving here, I was going, oh my God, I am so tired. I really need to dial up the energy. And filling out the onboarding form, you referred to a metaphor of academia being a toxic boyfriend.
Yeah.
And I was like, stop, cut the cameras. I want to park the metaphor.
Okay.
I'm actually keen to hear about a toxic boyfriend. Is that from experience? That toxic
yes.
Boyfriend? Okay. Because I was like, oh, there's a clue. She's talking about a metaphor in academia, but I want to talk about the boyfriend. Yeah.
I honestly lose count. I think it's been maybe 2 or 3 years since I've come out of an almost 10-year relationship.
Is this a long-distance one?
Yes.
I read this online. That's...
Oh.
Well, you wrote something. I think it was an RNZ.
Oh, yeah.
For the RNZ thing, it was like a 7-year long-distance relationship. And I was like... And in my notes, I've got caps. 7 years long-distance? You need to tell me what... Tell me what? Why? How?
We met when I was doing study abroad in the United States, and I was there for a semester in my second year of uni after being devastated by not getting into med school because I was in pre-med.
Really?
And I was in a deep, dark depression hole. That's all I wanted to do. So I was like, I don't know what I want to do. And I think my parents felt really sorry for me. So, they supported me in doing a study abroad. Anyway, I met him there. Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense then.
Yeah. But he's not American. He was also an exchange student. I wonder how much detail. Anyway, he was from a European country studying in a different European country than he was born in.
Mm.
And we met.
How old were you when you met?
20.
So you spent most of your 20s in this relationship?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And if you do the maths, we ended around the time of COVID. Obviously, obvious reasons, but also for the reasons of perhaps not us not being able to reconcile or make enough compromises to be no longer long distance. Because it was like almost 10 years of long distance.
That's a long time to do long distance.
And it was long distance. I think we probably spent maybe 4 to 5 months a year together. And I also lived, it would just be really funny if he was listening. But I moved. I lived in London for like 18 months. Didn't love that. So I came back. And this was, I would say, relatively earlier on in the relationship.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. I'm somebody who really likes change. I don't know, like I had already gave it a go moving to where he was. I didn't love it. So I was kind of like, well, it's your turn.
Yeah.
And then it kind of never happened. So then it was just like, I guess we were kind of in a limbo. And then I guess towards the end, I almost moved to his home country and was very close to like getting married and having babies.
How close?
I would say if I was running on very little sleep, I might have jumped the gun and have done it. Wow. But it was just, yeah, I was kind of like, man, I just know that if I did that, I would definitely have postpartum depression. I would be depressed. I would hate my kids. I would hate him. I would hate everyone.
Mm.
And I would just be so miserable. And so I was like, I don't think I should do that. And then COVID happened. Because after that, we were like, okay, now what? And oh, I don't know. It was just such a messy end.
Did he come back here much, or was it mostly you going over there?
He has spent quite a bit of time here as well. But I mean, we've like broken up and then gone back together.
Yeah.
Like there was a period okay. where we got back together and we were broken up for maybe almost a year. And then we had booked tickets to go to one of our friend's wedding and the university that we met. And then it just kind of like resuscitated something that should have been kept dead.
As someone who has done that, relatable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was like,
why do we do that?
I don't know. And you know the
why
thing
do
is,
we fucking do that?
And I really kind of, I don't know if I hope that he's listening, but when I first met him, I came back and I was telling my girlfriends about him and I said, he's the kind of guy that you fuck, not the kind of guy that you'd marry.
And you know those early on Erica
instincts
insights
were so on point. Yeah. And I, after like we properly ended things, I was like, wow, if that is not a loud and crystal clear hammer to the head message from the universe of listen to your gut, I was like, wow, okay, I hear you loud and clear, because it's really come back and bit me in the ass.
I get it.
Yeah.
I get it. Yeah.
Do you?
Yes. Yeah. I get that so hard.
Yeah.
That intuition or that first instincts usually is so right, and we spend so much time and energy trying to convince ourselves this is going to work because I'm really strong and you know we're gonna do this together.
Well, you know, you're like rationalizing you're coming up with a logic to make it okay. And you know, it's just all the other instincts that I had throughout the relationship.
Yeah.
In the end, I was like, fuck, I was right.
Yeah.
And I thought I was crazy.
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah.
1,000%.
I was nuts.
Yeah.
Like, I am that, you know, crazy, wide-eyed, you know, that crazy girlfriend.
Yeah.
I mean, total guess.
We're really bonding right now.
Yeah. You know, what do you call it? What's the word for like looking back?
Hindsight.
Hindsight is, what's the
2020.
2020. Oh my God. I've been doing this all day in my class today. Today I was like asking my students like, what's the word that I'm thinking of? And they're like, I don't know.
No, hindsight is 20/20. And yeah. How do you feel about, because so much of your 20s was spent in that. When you look back now.
How do I feel about it?
Yeah. Because I'll tell you how I feel about it.
Okay, how you feel about it.
No, because so I spent the last 5 years of my 20s, the same sort of deal, although not long distance. In fact, we were living together for most of that time. And I look back, and now when I hear about people who are in relationships, particularly if they're in their 20s, I'm just like, if you've got an inkling that something's not right, get the fuck out. Do not marry that person. Yeah. Do not have babies when deep down you know that it's not it. I remember being asked when I was with my ex, what do you love about him? And I couldn't really give a really great answer. I couldn't really give a right answer, but I kind of was like, oh, well, you know, we're in love, so all good. And looking back, I'm like, if you can't answer that question, if you don't have like some answers to that question, some actual substantial facts, then that's a problem.
You know what I realized when I got asked that question? It wasn't even like, oh, we're in love. I was like, oh, we're past that. You can't be in love for 10 years. Yeah, you love each other as coexisting people who have shared such a large part of your lives. I've been talking about this for the last couple of years with my girlfriends. I was 20, right? And coming out of it, you know, some of my girlfriends have been dating for 10 years, right? I was like, I got in a relationship with him because he said he liked me.
Yeah.
That was it. And I don't know. I feel like in general in life, I'm an adapter, right? Like if I'm in a situation, I make the most of it. And I think, you know, when I was going through high school, the norm was like, if a guy says he likes you, then it's like, oh my God, amazing. Let's be this thing. I don't stop to think, do I like him? I'm like, oh, I like him because he likes me. I've been chosen. I feel like that was very much my experience. And it was very much my experience up until the boyfriend before this one. But then that one ended up being a dud because he was cute, but he was just not what I thought. Really great person. But just
incompatible.
And so, to that question, what do you like about him? I'm like, well, I've learned to
put up with him.
I've learned to appreciate, like I've always said throughout the entire relationship, we're not the most compatible. We're not the perfect match, but relationship is a choice. You make it work. And I don't know if maybe it's like an individual case study of the model minority embodied. You know?
I grew up with very little romantic attention.
Yeah.
So when I was 25 and started getting some, and this guy was like, when I was like, oh, okay, he likes me, sweet. If I had advice for people in their 20s, actually anyone, if you can't answer the question, what do you love about that person, and it's and you're not really giving an answer, wouldn't you want to be, this is me personally, I want to be inspired by someone. I want to admire someone for their courage and how loyal they are, how interesting they are.
Oh my God, I feel so bad listening to this because I'm just like referring, did I feel any of that for my ex? I didn't.
No.
I really did not, you know, like him.
I would love them to have like good taste or just be interested in the world, have a degree of curiosity.
He had good taste, but it was his mum's taste.
Yikes.
You know, also we were 20 when we met and you know, I ended up studying sociology, right? Our values were very different by the time we were in our late 20s, and so that was also like, wow, how can you live the world with that kind of view? You are a monster. But I was like, oh, maybe we just don't talk about it.
I mean, one hand, grateful to have that experience. Boy, did that build who I am today.
Yeah.
But also I think back, I'm like, man, those were like prime years in terms of energy and body.
Yeah.
And so much energy was focused on this external person.
Yeah. I mean, look, when I broke up and I said, fuck, I said to my mum, I was like, fuck, I've wasted 10 years of my life. And my mum, bless her.
What did she say?
She was like, No experience is a waste. There's always a lesson that you learn. Sorry, Mum, if you're listening. Which is true. And I got a lot out of it, of the relationship, in the sense that I got to travel a lot.
Great. Saw the world.
That's
definitely a,
really,
a plus.
But I feel like maybe that was about it. I don't know. I don't know what young people are like these days. I mean,
you're pretty young. I mean,
young people like Gen Alpha and Gen Z, like people experiencing high school now. I would implore the listener to ask themselves the question, do I like them? Do I actually like them? You know, like, or do I like them because I mean, for me, I feel like all of my boyfriends have been, yeah, I like them because they like me. And I look at them, there's no common thread in terms of aesthetics, personalities.
It's just the attention.
Yeah. And I think also I think it was largely shaped by also by my Asian womanhood. I went to Rangitoto College and most of my friends were white and my social group was also very white. So I was the Asian person in the group. And so, and it was a time where like my very closest dear friends would be making jokes like, oh, let's go get a piece of dental floss and you won't be able to see. Oh. It was that era.
Oh no.
It was that era. And
were they really your friends?
My dear girlfriends, if you're listening, I am sorry.
Oh, so you're still friends with them?
Yeah, aren't they? Repented this. We've all grown up. But it was that kind of era. And so I think for me, I was so hyper paranoid that like, no one's going to like me because I'm Asian.
Yeah.
And then also hyper paranoid, if someone likes me, is it because I'm Asian?
Yeah.
And then that's also why, you know, like, it's just, it's, life is just easier if I just don't.
Yeah. Yeah. Are you dating now?
No, I'm not. I've just heard so many not great stories. And I've been on the apps and I went on one date.
Which app did you use?
Hinge. I don't know. I think the whole dating experience kind of made me think maybe I'm asexual. I just felt I hated the idea of like having the same small talk conversations. And it's gross. And that's the last thing I want to do after a day at work.
Totally.
And then you got to dress up. And then and you know, like,
there's so much effort.
Yeah. And then like be interested in a person who looks very different to what they looked like in the photos. That one date I went on, lovely person, I'm sure. What he did was probably standard. I don't know. You tell me if it's standard.
I don't know. Yeah. Tell me though.
He was like, oh, I Googled you. I read some of the stuff that you've read. Oh, you've written. And so he was like, oh, tell me about that. I don't know. Maybe
I feel like that's nice. What are you doing?
Yeah, I was just going to say, maybe that's nice. But I was like,
he's trying to engage you on your level.
I was like, oh man. I was like, man, I get paid to talk about stuff like that. I don't want to talk about that. I don't want to talk about like navigating identity as a person of color in New Zealand. Like, I don't want to do that outside of work. And so it ended up feeling like almost like a therapy session for him me giving him like and explaining my experience and what I wrote and how that could be like a parallel experience for him. And it just felt very much like how I feel when I'm in lectures or in tutorials rather than like, oh.
Yeah.
What's been your dating experience?
Non-existent.
Yeah. Have you been on the apps?
I haven't been on the apps this side of COVID. I want to do an arranged marriage. Or like, oh my set God. Me up. Okay. Someone set me up.
Yeah. Okay, no, I totally get you. Like, and it's a very Korean thing.
Is it?
Like people setting you up. Not like arranged marriage, but like someone will be like, oh yeah, there's my friend has a son and la da da da. And people set people up on blind dates. It's very, very common. Even, you know, like what we typically understand as arranged marriage. Now I'm kind of like, that's kind of dope. Because it's like you've sussed out their family history. You've sussed out that they're economically stable. I don't know, whatever else that they check. So at least worst case scenario, you can have a house and some kind of, you know, you can coexist without it being like a crumbling hot mess. But, I mean, your parents take the person off.
Yeah.
That seems like it does all of the hard work for you.
Yeah.
And, you know, like I said, I'm an adapter. I'll adapt.
Yeah. I just, you know, if we could crowdsource a guy for me, you know.
And I've asked my friends, I'm like, but I've known them for so long that I know all of their acquaintances. Yeah. And I'm
this
not.
This is my problem. The circle is not changing.
Yeah.
It's very, and I don't like leaving my house.
Oh my like, God, same. So
I don't even go to the grocery store because I get them delivered. Like, I don't.
I feel like majority of my time outside of work, I spend at the grocery store. But, you know, I just, the whole dating thing, the dating app thing, I just felt, and people have told me that I will get over it, that you get over it really quickly. But it's just like, man, picking a photo, I was like, which photo best represents me? And then I start going down a rabbit hole, I'm like, what do I look like? What do I look like to other people? What I think are good photos of me, do I look like that in real life?
Do you know what? I just had to get my license renewed because it expired. And so now I'm stuck with this photo for the next 10 years. And when I got it done, it was like, it's kind of cooler now, but it was really stinking hot.
Mm.
And the queue, I had to queue up for ages. There was no aircon. I'm like sweating. My fringe is fucked. I got this photo and it's so bad. And then I showed my workmates and they're like, oh, that's nice. I'm like, is that what I look like?
Isn't that just the worst? I recently got my license renewed and I actually spent time. I watched a little clip of, you know, how Kim Kardashian or whatever Beckham, Victoria Beckham took a whole camera crew to was the DMV.
That, that was Kim, wasn't it?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Something, someone like that.
Yeah, some famous person. And I was like, I had like lined up to watching this YouTube tutorial about how to do your makeup for license photos.
Oh my God.
I didn't end up watching it, but I did put in a significant amount of effort to go get it taken. And I didn't want to be that asshole. I was like, can I have a look? And I'm like, oh, can you take it again?
You can't. They won't do it. There's a sign saying you will not see the photo.
Oh, really?
You won't get to proof it. Oh. You get one shot. That's the end.
I didn't even
see it.
Oh.
Anyway, fucking.
I thought that was an option. And I was like, I'm not going to be that prick. Mm. And so I didn't ask. I'm cool about it. And then I got my license in the mail. And I was like, oh, my God. And that's a photo of me after I've put an effort. And then I showed it to some of my friends. And they're like, you look so nice. And I was like, that is so mean. That is so mean. And I was like, you know, experiencing the I was like, wow, that's me.
Really put things in perspective. What were we talking about? Oh, yeah, so the dating. I think the company that owns Tinder and Hinge, I think there are a couple of them in the States. They've just been taken to court, I think. I don't know. I saw it. It was... it was for gamifying, something to do with gamification of the apps and making people pay for shit. There's like some sort of dodgy dating app shit going down.
Oh. Is that something that you can sue them for? I mean, we live under capitalism.
Someone Google it. Okay. Yeah, I've got no interest. Sometimes I'll go through phases of my interest peaking a little bit. I'm like, oh, maybe it's time to go on the apps. Maybe it's time to go on find someone or whatever. But also I'm like, really?
Yeah, I say my mom has mentioned a couple of times, are you seeing anyone? And I'm like, no. But I do really want someone to live with when I need housework done and gardening and lifting heavy shit. Yeah. And
putting together flat pack.
Yeah, and like unloading the dishwasher before I get home.
Car shit.
Yeah,
I know.
Car stuff. Yeah. And just stuff. And mom's like, that's not a boyfriend. I feel like you need like
a mate.
Yeah. Because I was like, man, I don't want to share my bedroom because I don't want to sleep. I don't want to share my bed because I can't really sleep.
Mm.
This person can't live where I'm living.
In saying that, I would appreciate splitting the rent.
You know what? That's actually the one thing that I've thought about.
Because the costs are high.
Whoa, over a year? That's a lot of savings.
Because my rent is really high. So that would be nice.
You know, like I was asking my sister, I was like, what do you like about your partner? I was like, why do you like...
why do you like them?
I was like, oh, and because she's so happy. And she's like, he just makes life better. But that's like, but don't you want life to be like better and good on your own? Because then you're like codependent. Speaking from experience. I guess I would have to meet someone who would really improve my life. And I think men are not very good at that.
Well, okay, so what I'm trying to do is reframe Okay. I don't want to be, I've been the person that's like, there are no good men out there.
Mm.
And I just, I'm really trying to not keep manifesting that.
Yeah.
I'm trying to be Delulu, like yeah. optimistic.
You know what you should try, which I've been trying, is that like when I go to the gym or the grocery store, mm-hmm. I try to make eye contact with men.
I don't like eye contact.
I try to make
eye contact. I don't like that.
In the hopes that like, that's how people must have met in the olden days, right? And I was like, maybe we'll vibe. Maybe there'll be sparks. And I was thinking, man, if I met someone in the gym, then I feel like that's a keeper because I look horrendous at the gym. I am wearing my 12-year-old t-shirt and, you know, just hot red in the face. And if they can fall in love with me in that state, then it's like, I got nothing to hide.
Mm.
But this can be a comfortable, you know, relationship.
Would you want someone that's as educated as you?
I think for me, the qualification is not much of an importance. It's just about level of, I guess, like critical thinking and critical engagement. I have a lot of friends who are very critical citizens who haven't been to university.
Yeah, yeah.
I just think it's a bit hard to find that in men in the age demographic that I'm looking for. Oh, actually, no, I wouldn't know. I haven't looked. Yeah.
Anecdotally, I feel like that is a, yeah, where are they?
like the progressive ones, I feel like are a little bit too hipster / too young. And then the ones that are in my age bracket are already married and have kids or divorced or, you know, whatever. Which, you know, I don't have a problem with, but I am barely taking care of myself. I mean, first is that I don't want my partner to be someone that I have to take care of. Like, I don't want a man child.
Yeah.
I don't want someone that I would hold a grudge because I have to passive aggressively do all the housework.
Yeah. I don't want my partner to be like a child.
Yeah.
Who I'm supporting.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I feel
like what are you bringing to the table?
I mean, exactly. Exactly. And I, you know, don't engage in the dating game because I feel like it's just a minefield when you're not like a white woman. Or I don't know, a white woman, prove me otherwise. I just feel like when I'm on there, you know, it is very much face value.
At the same time, I do want to be optimistic. I am optimistic.
Do you want to eventually be with someone married, baby?
I'm not super maternal. I speak to some women and like, I just really want to have a baby.
Mm.
I don't have that inkling. Like, I wouldn't want to do IVF on my own and have a child.
Mm.
Some women have that, you know, my purpose, my heart, I'm like, I love having kids, which is cool. But I don't feel that way.
When women say that, I'm like, is it because you've been brainwashed by the patriarchy or like you actually want it? And then if you actually want it, have you really thought about it?
Like, I guess people are into different stuff.
Yeah.
Some of that involves making babies. That's all good. Like,
yeah.
You do you.
Yeah.
But personally, if it happens with the right person, fine.
Mm.
But I'm pretty sweet now.
Mm.
How about you?
I love kids. I love babies. Have you seen the Netflix TV show The Chair with Sandra Oh? An academic.
No.
In a very white English department at an old university in the United States.
Is there a really average white guy?
White
in
guy, yeah. That's her.
Okay, I think I have seen it then.
Yeah, yeah. well, she has an adopted child. And when I saw that, I was like, man, she's like living my life. And as in, I was like, I can very easily see myself in one variation of the future like that. Because I don't know, by the time maybe I feel like I'm ready, I might not be able to, I might not have a partner. I also hate the idea that like creating a baby like needs a man. But like, I also know what it feels like to really want a baby with someone who you love.
Mm.
Because despite all the shit talking I've done with my previous relationship, there was a moment where I did feel like, man, I love him so much. It would be amazing to create a human that's me and him.
Yeah, I was there too. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So I get it. I don't know. Maybe someday it'll happen. Maybe some, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll meet my person of dreams at Pack and Save tonight.
Look out. Okay, you've been asking questions. Okay, let me have a look. I'm going to read this blurb. Decoloniality is not a cancellation, villainization, nor rejection of Western thought. It is also not a blind return to what once was, an endeavor that often involves fetishizing.
That's how much you're repulsed by the idea of fetishization.
And romanticization of traditions. Rather, decoloniality. Thank you. Is once again a project of re-existence, understood as the redefining and re-signifying of life in conditions of dignity. It is an exercise in epistemological considerations to situate the one amongst a constellation of many to garner the capacity for multiplicities, difference, and expansion. What do you think about that now? This is from 2020.
Okay. Yeah. I still very much resonate with that.
What's helped you in your own journey of decoloniality? Well, you know what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. What has helped me? Writing that. Because I think, I said I didn't prep for this, but I did think through some potential questions that you might ask me. And I was thinking about, you know, why I decided to kind of teach and study in the field of academia. I think, you know, maybe to a certain extent, it might be a defense mechanism in that it gave me the words to be able to justify and rationalize my experience. And I guess kind of the tools to be able to speak up for myself. And to explain what it is that I'm experiencing in a way that has weight to it. That's not just like, this is how I felt. But it's like, this is how I felt, and this is connected to broader social patterns and issues that are stemming from these situations, you know? So it's not like this flippant thing. And so I felt really empowered by that when I started studying sociology. And, you know, it's like, I think maybe my personality outside of academia is like, all of my friends, like, think I'm super dumb. I'm really street dumb, but I'm book smart. So the way that I have been treated is that, like, when I say stuff, people are like, yeah, whatever, right? And so I feel like maybe because of that experience, I found academia to be really helpful, and that it kind of gave me conceptual vocabulary as a kind of an ammunition to be able to explain myself in a way that was also considered, you know, quote unquote, legitimate by society.
Mm.
Yeah, because it's quote unquote research, academia, whatever, the ivory tower, the knowledge where ideas come from. Mm. And I think writing that thesis was an interesting experience. If you have read it, I wrote it at a very interesting time in my life. I had 2 years to write it, and I ended up getting lots of extensions for it because I was getting attacked by white supremacists on campus. So I had, in theory, 2 years, but I wrote the whole thesis in like 10 days.
Really?
Yeah. Because, I don't know, I was like 10 days of like haze, but it was like an ecstatic experience. I was like hardly sleeping. I was smoking a lot. Sorry, Mom. I don't smoke anymore. Smoking a lot. Just staying up for 10 days, like on coffee, cigarettes, pacing around, and it was just had to be like ejected out. Mm. And I think I was just trying to make sense of, like, where do I fit in? What does my experience mean? How can this be meaningful in context of what I'm experiencing? I think most of my academic work is selfish in the way that it's me trying to understand and make sense of what I'm experiencing in context of other people's experiences, in context of the particular historical moment, in particular space of having inherited socio-historical, you know, burdens. And it's been surprising to me that in doing that, and in the times where I have tentatively put it out in the world, that a lot of people have resonated with it. I feel like as you read more and more, like as it gets to the end, kind of turns into dog shit, because I was like, by the time it was like day 11, I was like, oh fuck, I just want to get this done. So my supervisor actually didn't read it at all because I was writing it right up until the deadline.
Oh my gosh.
And you know, I'm such a perfectionist that I, you know, try to make the writing perfect as I go. Mm. Rather than like writing a shit draft, and, okay, which is awful practice, and I tell my students never to do that. Because then you will never get it done. But I think that, I don't know, that adrenaline and I was like having weird, like lucid dreams, which I think I wrote about the dream in one of the sections in the thing. But perhaps I stand by the central tenets of tenets.
I don't know.
Of what I say, because it wasn't overthought. It really is a captured moment of what I was thinking at the time in terms of interpreting my experience with the tools that I had.
Yeah. That's a snapshot of where you were at that time.
Yeah, yeah. And surprisingly, I still kind of stand by the principled values around what I've said. So in terms of decoloniality, I very much still understand decoloniality in that sense.
Yeah.
I mean, as I was listening to you read that, I was like, well, who the fuck wrote that? That's a lot of words.
You did. I think that's might be why it has resonated so much, because you did do it, you did smash it out, and there was some of that unfiltered stuff, and at the end you're just like, fuck it, turning it in. I also find it really interesting you're talking about how you're sensing that academia is something for you, like as a defense, or like you're building up armor so that you're armed and ready.
Mm-hmm.
Something for yourself. You use the word selfish.
Mm.
Where I talk to quite a few people on here, that's them and their creative, their art, same thing.
Mm.
You've said that you don't see yourself as a leader. What would it take for you to feel like one?
I don't know, somebody who's like switched on all the time and really proactive with community engagement, proactive with like producing stuff, putting stuff out there. I don't know, be recognized by Forbes 30 under 30, except I'm not under 30. Maybe 40 under 40.
People pay for that. I think it's fake.
It's a construct. I don't think I've done anything to warrant a title of a leader. What have I led? Nothing.
I'm wondering if that's how other people, for you maybe at work, at uni, I wonder if they see you differently. Do you teach many Asians?
You know, actually, so after I didn't get into med school, and when I moved to London, came back, the first paper I did was a sociology paper on ethnicity and identity. And that's when I really like explored that. And I was like, wow, I didn't know there was something that you can study that's fun. I grew up in Korea. Studying is supposed to be painful, you know, rote memorization. I had to write an autoethnography, which is basically you write about your experience and then you make sense of it, analyze it in terms of in context of the society that you're living in. And when I wrote that, I couldn't find anything about other Korean New Zealander experiences. Mm. Like nothing at the time. Even about Chinese New Zealanders, I couldn't find anything. And I was like, what the hell? You know? Mm. Like, and so at that moment, I remember asking the lecturer at the time, I was like, what would it take for me to be in the position where you're in? I want to do what you're doing. For me to have access to, I don't know, for the world to have stuff that I can reference. And so she kind of like, you know, like talked me through it. And I think that's when I was like, wow, I would love to one day teach this particular course and contribute something that people can read and resonate with and feel seen, that their experience is something that is documented as legitimate. Because in academia, if it doesn't exist, it doesn't exist. Like, it's, if you can't reference that, doesn't mean shit all. And so that's very much how I felt. It's like, oh, my experience means shit all, because there's nothing that anyone's written about it. And I came from like the STEM sciences. Like, I did biophysics chem in high school. So I had no idea in terms of like, I don't know how to fucking write or whatever. But anyway, like, fast forward, I ended up lecturing that course.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, when was it now? Maybe 2 years ago? I got the opportunity to lecture that course, and I rewrote the course. And I also got to lecture Understanding Aotearoa, Sociology 101, which is a Gen Ed big stage one sociology paper. I tutored it several times, saw a lot of flaws with it as a frustrated grad student, which I bitch about in the thesis. And then I got to a position where I was given the opportunity to lecture those courses, and I got to rewrite the courses. So I taught them the way that I wish it had been taught to me. You know, Asians, especially East Asians, are a rarity in the social sciences and the Faculty of Arts. I had moments where I had some instances where, yeah, I had like Asian students, whether actually both East Asian, South Asian, come up to me and say, it's really cool to see an Asian woman like talk about this and to unpack my experience. So, I mean, for sure, I would have loved to had that when I was a student. Hopefully they felt seen.
Yeah.
And hopefully they felt like they had a legitimate enough I don't know, sense of existence to be acknowledged in a course as like a module or whatever. But then I think for me, I am so paranoid and such an overthinker that I really haven't put out anything out there in terms of like writing. I don't think I've written anything since my thesis because I am so paranoid and scared of being dissected, because I think that's also the sociological tendency to be just hypercritical. And because I'm like that, I don't want to put anything out there, and I'm too scared to put anything out there. So after I wrote my thesis, one of the examiners said that I should turn some of the chapters into journal articles, but I'm just like, oh my god, it's not good, I don't know what to say, blah blah.
Wow.
Yeah.
What would you write about if you didn't have the fear of being dissected?
Honestly, like, I would just write about, once again, just making sense of my current experience, right? I think I also got to a point where I felt like I felt obliged to write about certain things. And I kind of felt like, I feel like it's already been said and done. There's a term like rote narratives, which is that it's the same repertoire of experiences that people have, like the lunchbox trauma of Asian kids, right? Yeah. I was like, yeah, like, I could, I'm like, what's the point of banging? I was like, I feel like I need to bang on about it for the sake of like, oh, like talking about trauma.
Yeah.
Talking about race. And so I kind of felt like, oh, I need to talk about race, and I need to talk about being tauiwi in context of like te tiriti waitangi. And then it didn't feel fun for me anymore, and it felt like a job, and it just didn't. And then it also made me so paranoid that it's like, wow, fuck, I could say one wrong thing and I could just be cancelled. And as somebody who has been in a position of like lecturing a course, that's like career suicide. If I was really selfish, I would just write about like maybe unpacking my toxic relationship.
Yeah, honestly, I would be interested in reading it. Let's, yeah.
Because
write something about relationships in the contemporary world.
Yeah, because I am kind of sick of race.
Yeah. Look, as someone who's got a podcast called Asian, I'll do that one. Listen, I don't want to talk about any more lunchboxes.
Yeah.
I get it. Yeah. I get it. I very intentionally did not want this podcast to be a trauma porn, trauma dumping zone. Yeah. Just because there is enough of that in the world.
Yeah. And at a certain point, I was kind of thinking, how is this serving me now?
Yeah.
I did think there was a point where it did serve me to explore it.
Yeah.
It did serve me to explore and make sense of me navigating identity. But now I'm like, oh, I'm bored.
Yeah.
But I also feel like, well, I found it so useful and cathartic and healing in making sense of it that maybe I should formalize it. Or then maybe I should talk about it, but I don't want to talk about it anymore.
Yeah, I so get that.
Yeah. So, I kind of want to talk about things. I don't know. This is what it must be like for like white men. It's like, oh, just talk about things that are like interesting in your life, not like talk about like, being a woman, being Asian.
Yeah.
So I can just talk about,
they can have podcasts about what they want.
Yeah. I don't know, like how cabbage causes gassy stomach, and that's a real issue in my life. And that's like, that's my thing. You know, my thing isn't like being Asian or being a woman or being a migrant or whatever.
What does your downtime look like?
I'm at the supermarket. My downtime, I hang out with my cat. Yeah, I go to the supermarket. I really enjoy grocery shopping, looking at all the food.
Do you?
I love, you know what, it's kind of weird, but I feel like when I'm in the grocery and fruit aisle, it's like I'm in nature. Oh my God. But like a contained space where there's no bugs.
You feel like, and then, you're really connected.
Oh yeah. And I like spending time picking out the thickest, girthy corn. You know?
Oh my God.
It's like an experience. And then I'm getting my steps in as well.
You're connected to the land in the fruit and veggie aisle.
And then if I feel real wild, then, you know, I go to the processed food aisle. Oh. I'm training for a couple of running races.
Really?
Yes. My parents have become one of those like really unrelatable athletic people who run marathons for fun.
Wow.
Yeah. I was kind of like, Oh, it's gone to, but my dad, he used to weigh like 100 kilos. Now he weighs less than me. And I was like, I feel so triggered.
How old are your parents?
My parents are, I believe, just below 60. They lived in New Zealand. They moved back to Korea maybe 5 years ago. But anyway, so they are now part of this like health and fitness friend group. And
I'm wary of runners. To be honest, it's kind of a cult. My brother has just started running. I watched the podcast Trixie and Katya.
Oh my god, I love them. I love them.
The podcast. I watched that religiously.
Katya was saying
running is a form of self-harm. I'm like, I see that. Whenever I hear someone's on run, I'm like, you're running from something. What is happening?
I get it. But I also think like...
No, I'm teasing. Good for you.
To be cliche, like, it's good for your mental health. Yes. Blah, blah, blah. But for me, it's like a way to create like memories with my parents.
That is so nice and wholesome.
Yeah. And like do something where like we have something in common rather than like just going out to eat.
Yeah.
And watching TV. And it also gives us a great excuse to go somewhere.
Mm.
Like every time I've been back to Korea, we've been doing lots of like trips within Korea to like rural places. And so I'm doing my first official race, a 5K in Gwangju, which is like south. And I've always wanted to, oh no, is it there? Oh, maybe it's not there. I don't know, somewhere. But anyway, but it gives my dad like an excuse to like plan out trips, and he loves planning. Mm. And then it'll be kind of, I'm sure he will be racing ahead of me, but you know, it'll be like a really good, wholesome, shared experience.
Cute.
Yeah. So that's what I've been doing. And then when I'm not running, I'm recovering from running because I am aching and in pain.
Self-love, self-compassion, thoughts.
I think self-compassion is so important. I think for my type of personality anyway, where I'm super, super harsh on myself and really unforgiving to myself. Because I think self-compassion is what gets you to try again.
Yeah.
And what allows you to do things. Because I think perfection is the enemy. Being trying to perfect will paralyze you and won't. You won't do anything. You won't get anywhere.
Yeah.
Self-compassion is what will help, what will make you get back up and do the thing, with albeit it be imperfect. I always say to my students, done is better than perfect. Submit something rather than nothing. Only if I followed my own advice.
Isn't that always the case? That's so true though. The whole like not getting anything done because you want it to be perfect. I'm like that. I'm like that too. And I've spoken to many, many friends and people who, for example, they don't know what they want to do. They're in a job that they don't like. They don't know what they want to do next. They don't do anything because they're worried of making the wrong choice.
Yeah.
And so nothing changes.
Mm. And then you live like that and then you die.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think self-compassion is having that grace.
Yeah.
And that forgiveness and just allowing allowing yourself to just try something.
For me, self-compassion has looked on the contrary more like allowing myself to stop trying. To stop trying to be whatever the hell that you're trying to aim at. And just like, can you just be?
Can you just relax a bit?
Yeah. Can you just like exist?
Yeah.
Just pay the bills. Go get a job that pays you so that you can pay the bills and buy food.
Yeah.
And then just like be. You don't have to achieve anything. Don't have goals.
Yeah, but so there'll be some people who will totally hear that and be like, sweet. Yeah, but I totally know what you mean.
Yeah. So that, I feel like that's been me for the past 2 years. And it always takes so much cognitive work for me to say, that's okay. And it's been kind of good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Although then, you know, at 3 a.m., there is another voice that's like, the fuck have you been doing with your life? Waste of space. Where's your 5-year plan? Where are you going? But I think it's a constant balance. And for me, and I think, you know, since coming out of the relationship and I guess trying to navigate, like, what is love on my own? You know, what does love look like when it's just completely me? And what do I like doing? And I think, I mean, for me, probably for all the other type A's out there, for me, self-love and self-compassion has been like, man, just stop trying so hard. You are enough just being and existing. My mum always says, when I'm like having really terrible mental health days, my mum says, have you had breakfast? And I'm like, no. She's like, if you eat 3 meals a day, you go outside for at least 5 minutes, you have done more than enough. And I'm like, damn, mum, your bar is so low for me.
It's true, though. Simple.
Yeah.
Must it be so complicated and hard? What kind of stuff is important for you right now?
I feel like I'm kind of entering like a new chapter of creating something new. I've figured out that I can't be in academia in a conventional sense, because building up that career involves you being in decades of precarity and poverty and just terrible mental health. I love teaching. I love making things accessible for people and giving people ideas that give them more insights into their experience. I love that, and I really feel like I'm in my element. So I want to combine that, but also not be tethered to like an institution.
Yeah.
I don't want to be pressured to publish. I don't want to be pressured and be scared I'm going to lose my job when there's job cuts. I also don't want to be creating like stupid meaningless shit for some dumb company.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I am trying to figure out a way of how I can do that whilst having a sustained, stable income. And at the same time, that doesn't necessarily compromise my morals. Because I feel like, especially, I don't know, tell me if I'm wrong, but I feel like in the space of sociology, I feel like if you are not like fucking struggling, then you're like a traitor,
a sellout, is it?
Yeah. And I come from a very middle class like migrant family, so I don't come from a working class background, so sometimes I have felt like a fraud or something, you know. As my very good friend Justine Sachs, do you know Justine?
No.
Union organizer, we studied sociology together. She's the person who stopped Lord's concert in Israel.
Ah,
yeah. With the petition. Anyway, she's the bomb. She always says, Erica, you're allowed to have nice things. Something along the lines of like, Karl Marx wants us to have nice things. The dream is that everybody has nice things. And I'm like, yeah. Mm. Yeah, like having a house, having a nice car. Those are not disgusting bourgeois desires. Those are like, everybody, it would be nice if everybody could have that.
Mm.
And also, it's like having a house, it's like a human right. It's like, why is that something that we should feel guilty about? But I think that's something that I'm still navigating. And I think there's so much, for me, my experience has been that there's so much like face keeping you need to do in academia, especially in like that leftist space, to be like politically correct, but not in like a superficial way, like you have to be authentic. And it's just like, I feel like that really did me mental health damage, because I was constantly paranoid, and then it no longer felt like I was doing it because I felt conviction, but it felt like I was doing it just so that I don't get fucking cancelled.
Mm.
So what was the question?
What kind of stuff is important to you at the moment?
Yeah. Trying to like carve out a way to have those things.
Yeah. And so you're, how old did you say you are? Early 30s?
I'm 22. I'm 32.
Yeah, see, yeah. And I think that's your headspace. I think that's a good time. You're in a good age to be like where you're at.
Mm.
I think that's what the 30s is about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
American.
I think so.
Yeah.
You've just been through the chaotic Saturn return years. I don't know if you know anything about astrology.
Yeah, love astrology.
And now you're kind of, okay, coming out the other end of that.
Yeah.
Drama.
Yeah.
And figuring out, okay.
Yeah. And also, you know, like coming out of my relationship, realizing like, man, I can do shit completely on my own. And that's really cool.
It is.
Yeah. It's just, it's like, man, I'm a badass bitch.
Speaking of someone who's like hyper independent, it is great.
Yeah. I don't know. There's something about like, dear, I ain't got to rely on anyone. Like, I can do this.
It's very liberating.
Yeah. And it's like, well, I go to my job and that it pays me and I can do stuff with that and I don't have to rely on anyone.
Yeah. How spiritual would you say you are?
Maybe like 7.5 to 8 on a scale of spirituality, but not religious.
Has that increased, decreased, been pretty consistent in your adult years?
Spirituality?
Hmm. That rating?
I think the rating was a lot lower in my early 20s mm-hmm. because I didn't know the difference between religion and spirituality. And I was in complete defiance of Christianity, which is the religion that I grew up via my family. And so I kind of announced, I am not Christian. Don't believe in God. Fuck that. And to this day, I joke to my parents, I'm like, I'm Buddhist. Just to be like, I am not Christian. But I think since then, I think some the elements of the spiritual experience I had via religion was what kind of opened my eyes to, I guess, the experience of spirituality, but it's not what sustained it. Because I think once you kind of, I don't know, religion to me is a social construct.
Yeah, totally. I get it. And there is a hierarchy. Yeah.
No shade to anyone. I mean, if you have you practice religion, go for it. You do your own thing. My experience has been that religion has been a very oppressive experience. And an experience in which completely irrational things are justified according to things that make no fucking sense. That's been my experience.
Yeah.
But I think other than that, spirituality, I think, has been quite important to me. I think to me, it's kind of a connection and a conversation that I have with like the great unknown, aka the universe, God, whatever you want to call it. I think it's the same thing. I think having experienced lots of different things, I think it's talking to the same thing.
Yeah.
I am an absolute fiend for psychoanalysis, psychoanalytic theory. And my fave is this theorist called Lacan, who I talk about in the thesis. And his explanation of like existence was just like, I basically, everybody who did that course, we collectively experienced like ego death. And was like having existential crisis. But I feel like that was a spiritual experience for me because I think I realized his thing is that like we only exist through language. Like this sense of I, right? That's language.
Yeah.
You don't exist before language. And language is a social construct.
Yeah.
Right? So it's not neutral, right?
Yes.
So what you're constructed is a replication of the society, right? And all its values, right? So then who you are and who you think you are is not who you are. You know what I mean?
Yes, I totally know what you mean.
Yeah. Who you are is outside of language.
Yes, yes.
And what Lacan says is that that's the real.
Yeah. The essence of you.
Yeah. And
the
for me,
observer.
Yeah. And I've read Eckhart Tolle. Have you read
this
book?
Yeah. Yeah.
I feel like he's talking about the same shit, but in a spiritual book context, but Lacan is talking about the same thing. They're pointing to the same thing.
Yeah.
And so in that sense, I'm like, I live in conviction that that is... to sound really imperialistic, the truth.
Love it. Yeah. That I think it's a book. So Michael Singer, he's got a podcast as well. Does that ring any bells? The Untethered Soul. Again, it's very like Eckhart Tolle? I don't know. Same sort of vibes.
And you know, actually another thing is that like I understood that concept through psychoanalysis, which is part of this camp of theory called critical theory in sociology, and it's like kind of deemed as like extremely opaque and like very like elite and difficult to understand, right? And then I read The New Earth by Eckhart.
Oh yeah.
And I was like, what the fuck, that's so easy to understand. Yeah. And I was like,
yeah, that is, and it's sold and packaged to the millions.
Yeah, I was like, what the fuck, why is that? I'm like, what?
Yeah.
And so I think that was another moment where I realized like, man, like academia packages like real profound ideas in like the dumbest, most terrible way, and then makes us so inaccessible.
Totally.
And then like creates fucking degrees for people to understand this like terrible. For me, when it's something difficult to understand, it's terrible writing, and most of academia is terrible writing. And it's like, so I'm all about like democratization of knowledge, so it's just like, oh man, it's some dumb bourgeois shit, like fuck that.
Yeah.
Okay. I was like, Eckhart Tolle has done much more for humankind than fucking Lacan, even though I love Lacan, you know?
Oh, shit. Okay. Is there anything else?
I really didn't think we were going to talk about my relationship.
I really wanted to. As soon as I saw that you write about that metaphor, I was like,
there's something there.
I want to talk about that.
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. Finish these sentences. I'm feeling inspired by
the sun.
I'm really looking forward to
eating food that I didn't cook myself.
I'd love to be known for
making really difficult and cool ideas accessible.
Awesome. Erica, thanks so much for coming in for a chat.
Thank you for having me. This was really fun.
It was fun.
Yeah, it was really fun.
Cool. That's it. The end. This episode was made possible thanks to Foundation North, Creative New Zealand, and Big Fan. If you like what you're hearing, please subscribe, share, and review the podcast, and stay tuned for updates. See you next time.